It's election day in Duval again. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a closer look at today's runoff election in the city with your calls and tweets. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, funding critical mental health needs in Florida. It's the new focus for the Women's Giving Alliance. Plus, who made the cut? A look at Void's 35 under 35 list. All of that and more just ahead. But first this hour, once again, it's an election day in Duval County as several local races are headed to a runoff. And turnout is expected to be very low at the polls, as it has been throughout early voting. Still, these elections matter. Your vote matters. And it's not too late to get out and vote wherever you live in Duval County. Some of these races apply to you. Daniel Cronrath, professor of political science at FSCJ, is here to analyze the candidates and the races. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And the polls are open on this election day till 7 o'clock tonight. Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And so here we are, Daniel, on this runoff election day with five races still on the ballot. That's because these candidates, none of them that are still running, cleared that 50% plus one threshold to win their race outright in March. So here we are. It's a runoff.
That's right. Feels like it was only 2 months ago we were here.
That's right. Exactly
what it was. Yeah. So today's races is, you know, it's important. This is going to be the wrap up of, you know, what in Jacksonville, of course, we have our mayoral and a lot of our countywide elections and what we call an odd year election, meaning that it's not paired with any kind of federal election. I think that when you look, and this is a long running question relative to our turnout model here in the county, does this best serve us to have it on a day when, you know, as you know, according to our supervisors of elections office, that we may only have a 15% turnout? Does that really serve the city better by having it separate, but only having that kind of participation? Or should we be looking in the future, maybe if not a presidential election year, maybe moving it to what we would call the off-year elections, at least where there's, say, our governor is being elected or a senator from Florida is being elected. So we can at least, you know, increase our turnout here, you know, for very, very important offices. When you look at a lot of the issues that you cover here locally, you know, from the Jacksonville land into the future of our education, you know, really to have a 24% turnout in March, which is going to be determining the future for a lot of these important local decisions, you know, it's really saddening in some ways. And it speaks quite frankly, to a lot of the apathy that exists locally.
Yeah. 15% turnout today. We're down to friends and family and paid workers. That's about the level of participation maybe on some of these races.
Yeah, grab an able body, see if they're registered to vote, and drag them to the polls.
So it really comes down to which candidates can turn out their supporters, and it will come down to a few thousand people in some of these races. And as you said, Daniel, we in Duval County have these local elections at a weird time. We don't put them on the ballot in a big election cycle. We have them on a Tuesday. Increasingly, election reform advocates all over the country are calling for changes to the way municipalities conduct these kinds of elections to increase access to the ballot. Having election day be a national holiday has become a popular rallying cry, or having elections on a Saturday when more people can get to the polls. What do you think about all that?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a growing trend nationally when you, and this again comes back to partisan politics. Sadly, most things, when you look at why there's any kind of ripples in our political system, it happens because of the divisive nature now of partisan politics. I think that relative to high voter turnouts across the country or even in local levels, when a lot of people vote, Democrats tend to do better. When less people vote, Republicans tend to do better. So most national efforts, some folks who are viewers of your show or listeners of your show may remember, I think less than a month ago, Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate Majority Leader, had made comments almost mocking the idea of increasing or making a national holiday for people to vote, and basically saying that it's the responsibility of the voter to work with what they have now, you know, rather than trying to expand voting. Of course, Democrats across the board would love that. They would encourage that. They would want to create more opportunities for people to vote, because those lower information voters, the casual voter, maybe the voter who works two jobs, who can't get to the polls on an election day proper itself, those are the kind of folks that benefit from having an expanding a window to vote, and they're also Democrats. I think moving forward, I think, you know, one of the other things that I think Jacksonville, which of course we know is a fiscally conservative city, Melissa, I mean, this is, you know, very, very, our taxpayers here are very, very thrifty, is the cost. you know, how much money are we spending over the last decade, for example, to have our local elections on two separate days? You know, are we spending $1 million, $1 million plus just to have a 15% turnout in the second election that could be combined with other races? I mean, some folks, if you talk about fiscal prudence, would say that's not fiscally prudent. Why don't we maximize the one day when we're going to have all of these machines in place, all these workers in place, and hold multiple elections? So I don't know what the future discourse of that. I know if I were one a local Democrat involved with a local Democratic Party, I would look to try to get the election shifted to an on or an off year election where you have more Democrats voting. More people at the top of the statewide and national ticket. That's what typically Florida is still a purple state when you look at how close our elections are. However, when we don't have top of the tickets, big top of the ticket races, Duval does not go blue Vol. It tends to stay more Republican and more conservative leaning.
And give us a call right now as we speak with FSCJ's Daniel Cronrath about this runoff election day in Duval. Who will get your vote, beginning with the at-large races? Give us a call at 549-2937. Let's talk about these two races at the top of the ballot. These are countywide. Everyone needs to go out and vote in these races. City Council at-large Group 1, a runoff between Republican Terrence Freeman and Democrat Lisa King. And City Council at-large Group 3, another runoff between Democrat Tommy Hazzuri and Republican Greg Rochelle. Let's begin with Freeman and King.
Sure.
That's been an intense runoff with charges and countercharges flying between these two candidates. Who has the edge here?
Well, I mean, I think right now the traditional wisdom would have to be in a low turnout election with the amount of ads which have been run against Lisa King, albeit unfairly. When you look at the content of the ads and you actually go back and turn back the pages of history to see what they're basing the ads on. You know, to say that there's some falsehoods contained in the ads, I don't think is a stretch. However, they're effective and they've been bombarded and they've been all over the airwaves. And it's been very, very effective at using a lot of the typical buzzwords which favor Republicans across the board nationally. You know, liberal, you know, all the kinds of badgings that you would think that would be put into an ad have been used against Lisa King. But I still, at the end of the day, I think it's going to be a close race. I think you're right. I think when it comes to the grassroots efforts here in Jacksonville, I think Democrats do a better job in very, very low turnout elections at grabbing and pulling people to the polls. So we'll just have to wait and see. I think this one's going to be, this could be very, very tight.
Okay. Another race that is at large, Democrat Tommy Hazzuri, who did not win his city council race outright in March, surprising some given his popularity and deep political roots in the community, against Republican Greg Rochelle. Hazzuri lost some Democratic votes in March, some believe due to his vocal support for a Republican mayor, Lenny Curry. He's favored, though, to win in this runoff. Why?
Well, I would assume. I mean, you know, former Mayor Hazzuri has been in politics in Florida since in Jacksonville since 1974. You know, so you're really talking about, what, a 45-year history of being an elected official, more than 10-to-1 dollars on hand against his Republican opponent. And yet he couldn't close the deal in the first election. So I would think that tonight, I would tend to think conventional wisdom with the amount of money that he's still spending on ads to get elected, that it'll be a win for the former mayor. Now, I think it's going to be really interesting to see the margin. Of course, the other thing, Melissa, the backpinning of this story that you've covered very well is the fact that Hazzuri has such close ties to this mayor, you know, shooting ads for this mayor, going against the party, so to speak, some would claim. To run these ads. Of course, Tommy Hazzuri himself would say, listen, the mayor had no Democratic opponent. Therefore, me endorsing the mayor, I wasn't being disloyal to the party because the party failed to run a local Democrat for office. The default choice of the default choice for many Democrats, of course, as we know, is Anna Brochet, which if you know, in the mind of Tommy Hazzuri, obviously is not a registered Democrat. So there was no disloyalty there. So it'll be interesting to see that. I think if I were in either one of these camps, I think that the Hazzuri race should probably be less close than what the King and the Freeman race is going to be tonight. I think that the District 1 race could be very, very tight. And as we said, just in terms of matter of raw votes, and this is important for your listeners to know, if you don't think your vote matters, a lot of folks, I don't want to get involved. I don't really know the issues well enough. My vote doesn't matter. You could see races tonight, like in Council District 14 or one of these outlawed races, where you could have less than 100 votes determining who's going to be your elected official for the next 4 years. That's a very, very small number of people to sit back and say my vote doesn't matter.
Let's go to your calls now as we speak with FSCJ's Daniel Cronrath. Do you plan to vote this election day? What are your questions about the candidates? The race is on the ballot. 549-2937. Mark is in Mandarin. Hey, Mark, good morning. Go ahead, Mark.
Hi. Hi. As far as people not knowing about the election, that's actually not true, because the supervisor of elections sends out sample ballots to everybody who's a registered voter. And it says on there you can vote early between April Monday through Sunday. That's 7 days a week, April 29 through May 12 at 18 Jacksonville Public Library locations. So anyone can vote. Everyone knows about the election. As far as the comment that low-information voters would benefit by having it on an election where they're voting for people that they know about, so they'll just, like, vote, you know, party line or something because they have low information, they're not going to vote for this. Why do we want to encourage people who don't know anything because they haven't bothered to do the research and they have low information to vote? That just makes for you know, you get somebody elected who, you know, because people are voting for them, they don't know what they're doing. I mean, that doesn't make much sense. But everybody knows about the election. We have plans. This happens to be the first time I've ever voted early voting.
Oh, yeah?
Because I don't have to do any research. I've already done the research. I'm voting for the same people I voted for in March.
Well, Mark, I'm glad you're getting out there to vote. Thanks for that call.
Yeah,
thanks for your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Appreciate you getting out there and doing your civic duty. I think, you know, one of the things to clarify when we talk about low information voters is I want to be very, very clear. This isn't any kind of knock on the Mike Hogan's office. They've done a very good job. You're right. The dates are very well known. The mailers are sent out to all registered voters. I think it's more just a reflection that when we say low information voters, they may be the folks who are busy living their life and just not following politics as closely as you, Melissa, and I are, Mark. So.
That's right. Now, he mentioned how the supervisor of elections sends out the sample ballot in advance of the election so that people can look at it, get a sense of who they have to decide between when they vote. Let me quickly mention that a federal judge also ruled this week that election and voter registration materials in 32 Florida counties have to be redone because they were only printed in English. They have to be bilingual. In Duval County, not this cycle, but in a previous cycle, the local supervisor of elections was chastised for not providing sample ballots in Spanish so that Spanish-speaking voters could look at them. This is something to watch for next year. This is an important change at the polls that we're seeing due to this federal judge's ruling.
Sure. Particularly when you look at a lot of the counties, too, which have a larger Latino population than Duval. Of course, we have voters here who Spanish is their first language, and it was an important issue. But when you get to the center part of the state and down south, which is where this occurred with some of these counties, particularly with a lot of folks who moved here to the center part of the state after the hurricane in Puerto Rico, you know, there are a lot of U.S. citizens here who don't speak English, yet they're very, very involved with voting.
549-2937. Lots of calls on this runoff election day. Michelle is in Springfield. Hey, Michelle. Happy election day. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say I agree that it's just too spread out. I vote in every election and forgot until I heard you mention it this morning and thought now I got to rearrange my work day to get over there to vote because it's important to me. But I feel like I've been at the office register or voting, you know, once a month, and it just is getting so spread out. And, you know, with everything else going on in the world, I feel like we need to kind of make this a little bit easier for voters.
Yeah. Thanks, Michelle. And I hope you find time to vote. And she's right. Only the most committed civic-minded people are going to show up today.
Right. The nice thing is when you get over there, Michelle, you're going to find that the ballot is much shorter than it was last fall. When I went to vote early, there were actually only two races on my ballot. I never felt as if I voted as fast as I've done in previous elections. So for those people out there, this is not about where you're going to find, you know, a ton of amendments on there or judges that you've never heard of to send back to Tallahassee. It's going to be a very, very quick thing to do. You're not going to find a lot of long lines today, even though I know that the supervisors of elections office would love to have to deal with long lines today. Uh-huh. They're not going to be an issue. So, you know, get out there and vote. It's going to be quick and simple.
That's right, Michelle. You'll have two races on your ballot, just the city council at large, group 1 and 3. Most people, that's all they'll have to decide. But there are some other races for city council. Let's talk about them quickly. City Council District 8, two Democrats, Tamika Gaines-Holly and Jacoby Pittman. City Council District 10, also two Democrats, Brenda Priestley-Jackson and Celestine Mills. And City Council District 14, a Democrat and a Republican, Randy DeFore and Sonny Gettinger. And let's begin with the District 14 race. Randy DeFore, the Republican, seen as the quote-unquote machine candidate.
Sure.
With the backing of the mayor and his political machine against Democrat Sonny Gettinger, a Google executive.
Correct. You know, DeFore, deep-pocketed, you know, has benefited a lot from her connections with the mayor. She's raised a lot of money on her own. You know, putting out a lot of, you know, the big glossy 8.5 by 11 mailers that you're going to get in your mailbox. TV, of course, which is very, very interesting. You know, it used to be said that, you know, there would be a very low return on investment running for an individual council district and buying TV ads. Of course, today in the modern media, we know that a lot of these ads can be targeted to specific zip codes, you know, giving a lot more return on investment for a candidate who's able to raise the money and run ads. Gettinger, again, you know, Google executive, lived here for 10 years, raising kids. Goes to public school, has worked very, very hard on the campaign trail, attended a lot of rallies. I think this is going to be a tight one tonight. I think this is going to be one that you could be watching. And when I spoke before about a race that could be decided by 100 votes or less, just depending upon the turnout, you know, this could be a, because this is a very much a swing district over in 14. It's one of the more competitive districts
in
the city.
Let's talk about that. There aren't a lot of competitive districts in this city or in this state due to the way the lines are drawn. Of course, gerrymandering is a contentious topic, and lawsuits have been flying both in this state and many others to try to create more fair districts. This is a competitive district. You've got Riverside, Avondale, Murray Hill, which trend a little more Democratic, and then some sections of the West Side, which are more conservative.
Argyle, yeah.
Argyle in particular. So can Randy DeFore depend on Republican turnout in that part of the district to overcome what's been a really spirited challenge by a Democrat who has been competitive in the fundraising and in the fundraising effort and also in the grassroots sort of organization?
Yeah, I don't know. If I think traditional wisdom would be if you're in the DeFore camp, you're probably feeling pretty good. I think that you've done everything that you can. You've followed a typical Republican model. For getting elected locally, you've had a lot of assistance from a mayor who just won 57% of the vote, 58% of the vote, and didn't even have to go to the runoff. You've had the support of a sheriff appearing in ads with you, who is presumably very popular based upon the election results here locally. And then, of course, Gettinger has done, not only has she been able to raise money, but she's had a very, very active volunteer base. But the parallels here between the classic Republican and Democratic campaign, I think, are very, very much in play. Local Democrats getting behind, doing phone banking, going out, doing door-to-door, doing literature drops. Republicans relying on their typical messaging, getting TV out if they can. Very simple messaging, too. I think when you look at Gettinger's materials, and she talks about a lot of issues that we've talked about, and I've heard you talk about on the show, like resiliency for the city, what to do with sea level rise, you know, going into her expertise in the private sector and using the opportunity to rebuild the city and putting in fiber, you know, in all our neighborhoods and getting them wired and underground utilities and things like that versus the other side. And those are great issues. The other side, which basically is very, very simple, safety, officers. You know, using the things which resonate very, very simple with people who may be more casual to their politics. So, and that's not to suggest that either method is wrong or right. I just think it's really, really reflective of how both parties approach campaigning today.
And the Republican campaign playbook, as you pointed out, historically is effective in Duval County in these off-year elections, except for the Democratic districts that we're going to talk about right now. District 8, Tamika Gaines-Holly and Jacoby Pittman. And District 10, Brenda Priestley-Jackson, who's held office before, and Celestine Mills. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those two really quickly.
I think Brenda's in really good shape tonight, Priestley-Jackson. I would be shocked if she weren't to pull out that race based upon name recognition again and on her ability to raise money. I think, of course, Jacoby Pittman, who was a newer member to our council, who was appointed by Governor Scott. A well-known commodity when her role at Clara White. She's been a staple of our community and our nonprofit community for a very, very long time. But, you know, in terms of the fundraising, if you follow the money, her opponent's done a very, very good job of raising money to run against her. I mean, let's be aware of this. I mean, a lot of times we say they get the money out of politics, and that would be, of course, wonderful or ideal for some. But when you follow the money, it is a marker of support. And her opponent has almost raised dollar for dollar what she's been able to raise and put into this race. Now, again, with name recognition, I would think that Jacoby would have a certain advantage going into tonight's race. But I wouldn't take anything for granted, and I don't think any of them are.
All right. And a few more emails for everybody from our listeners on this runoff election day. Andy emails the show. I'm sure Tommy Hazuri will win his runoff because I have decided to forgive him. Okay. And that gets back to what you mentioned a minute ago, Daniel, which is that Hazuri has had to bring Democratic voters back into the fold in this runoff election. Here is another email. This one is from Catherine. Thanks for the coverage. Early voting does make it easier. There are several sites like Ballotpedia that cover all candidates and amendments. By the way, also go to WJCT.org. We have complete election profiles, and we'll have full results tonight on the election. Now, let's talk about the results of this, because, of course, Mayor Lenny Curry has gotten heavily involved in some of these races. He's trying to build a supermajority on the Jacksonville City Council to accomplish his second term agenda. And how likely is that for him to make sure that, you know, whether it's the Jacksonville Landing, which the council already voted to demolish, other priorities that he's going to unroll in the next year or so, how likely is it that this council will march, for the most part, in lockstep with this mayor?
Well, I think that really what you're looking at today is this would be an opportunity for the mayor and his team
excuse me,
to have a clean sweep. You know, really, the candidates who are coming today, you know, the race with Tommy Hazuri, for example, you know, whichever candidate emerges from that, he's either going to be getting Tommy Hazuri or a Republican, which in this particular case, both Hazuri and the Republican candidate will be lockstep with the mayor on most issues. But look at Jacoby Pittman, a Republican appointee to that seat, the ability to defeat Lisa King, you know, again, in a citywide race. This could be an opportunity for the mayor outside of that rogue voice out there, Garrett Dennis in District 9. You know, of course, and you had talked about last week about his effort to decriminalize marijuana here in Duval County. If things go to the way to the mayor's way today, Dennis could literally be just Garrett Dennis could be the only person which is standing between the mayor and not just a supermajority, a super majority, if you really want to look at the numbers of it.
At the same time, it's certainly within the realm of possibility that a few of these city council representatives are planning mayoral runs of their own, and yeah, they're going to get started on that before we know it.
Sure. I think for anyone who was despondent about 2019, the role of the local Dems, and I know this has been covered extensively and why they were unable to recruit a candidate, I don't think you're going to find this problem in 2023. I think you're going to see with Lenny Curry out of office and the fact that he won't have $4.5 million on hand to intimidate anybody who would run against him, there's going to be a lot of folks from, you know, your Tracy Paulsons, of course, who ran for the House seat, which overlaps the Council District 14 seat, and just a whole bevy of Democrats I think you're going to find are going to be more confident and really have a prospect to win at coming out of that. Anybody who would have gotten into this race, regardless of how well-funded they were as a Democrat, would have had a very uphill slog against Lenny Curry. Does that mean that the party should not have produced a candidate? That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm just saying it would have been very difficult for them to break through the enormous financial edge. And the fact that, I say this again, this mayor, I think that we're looking back historically, this mayor is very good at politics. There may be a lot of things policy-wise that we could argue about this mayor, from the landing to investment locally to the pension reform package that we'll be paying for now to 2060, which still blows my mind. But in terms of politics, this mayor is astute. He is an excellent practitioner. You can see why he was the head of the Florida Republican Party before getting elected. And I think at the end of the day, he's going to have a very good election cycle.
Let's have a few more calls. Meanwhile, on this runoff election day, Thomas is on the west side. Hi, Tom. Good morning. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning to y'all, too. I just wanted to say, yeah, I wonder about these off-year elections because the outcome, I don't think, does Jacksonville any favors. I think a 25% turnout in a mayoral election is just far too small to make that important decision. As for the specifics of this race, I've met three generations of the King family, and I got to say, I totally support them.
All right, Tom, thanks for that. And again, it's WJCT.org. Go to our website tonight for complete election results and profiles of all of the candidates, and get out and vote wherever you are in Duval County. Just because you don't have a local race that you are part of, there are still two countywide races. You need to get out and vote in today. The polls are open until 7 o'clock tonight. Daniel Cronrath, always good to have you on the show with your insights. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Melissa.
And much more still ahead later in the hour. Who made the list of voids 35 under 35? We'll take a closer look. But up next, a movable feast with Chef Mimi Lan. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. Back in a moment.
It's the 30th anniversary of an American tradition, the National Memorial Day Concert.
Join me, Joe Mantegna.
And me, Gary Sinise.
With Sam Elliott, Patti LaBelle, Alison Krauss, Dennis Haysbert, and General Colin Powell. It's a time to come together to honor and remember our troops, veterans, and our military families.
Thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
The National Memorial Day Concert.
Coming May 26th at 8 p.m. to WJCT Public Television.
A new chapter begins.
Now you can access more of your favorite PBS shows than ever before.
This is the future!
With PBS Passport, a member benefit that lets you binge many of the latest shows and catch up on your favorites.
We really are living in the modern world.
Anytime you want.
Wow, how about that?
Anywhere you are.
There's literally nothing like this in the world.
Learn more at wjct.org/passport.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. Well, she's making delicious waves here on the First Coast with an innovative dinner series that's one of the hottest tickets in town. In this week's Movable Feast, Lee Court speaks with Chef Mimi Lan, creator of the Viglo Dinner Series and the culinary firm Taste Curator. Take a listen.
Have a banana.
Tell me about the recent Viglo dinner and your philosophy of food.
Vietnamese food is one of the most healthy foods with lots of fresh vegetables. And I established Viglo, which is short for Vietnamese with global influences, because the new generation of Vietnamese food, I want to focus on better ingredients, no artificial flavoring or coloring, no MSG, and using better cooking techniques like with steaming and roasting and baking, sautéing instead of frying like the old generation. And because I travel so much, that I want to bring inspirations from globally and put into my authentic classic Vietnamese recipes to go well with the palate of the younger generations of Vietnamese nowadays, who travel a lot more than their parents' generation.
So you like to select upscale restaurants that people respect in our area and do your dinner there. And recently it was a 5-course exquisite evening, beautifully presented. Why do you think it's catching on here in Jacksonville? What is it about our region that people are understanding it and taking a chance and coming to your amazing dinners?
Yes, I think that Vietnamese food, even for people who know very little about it, are very enchanted with it, especially the dishes that are becoming very well known now, like the pho noodle, the banh mi, the spring rolls. So they're open to learning more about it. And one of the strains that I think I have than other Vietnamese chefs is that because I don't do this full time working in a restaurant, I get to travel a lot and I get to experiment in my kitchen. And so the Viglo dinners dishes that people get to experience are my own creations that they yes. can't get anywhere else.
Yes, and you've become known as the Taste Curator. I think that's such a unique name, you know, based on your travels and your experiences. You know, a curator is somebody who gathers the best of the best and shares yes. it with someone else. What advice would you give to young chefs today?
Well, one word, passion. Regardless of your background or experience or education, culinary school or not, but if you have that drive, that passion, and take every little job that was you were given to, even menial jobs like just chopping onions or doing something you think it's silly, but if you do the best job possible with that, and it translates to everything else you do, and people see what you do and give you more responsibilities.
And all all of the guests that I was dining with, they have become fans of yours. And the North Florida Viglow dinner featuring Chef Mimi Land. Thank you so much
for joining me
on Movable Feast. And we're going to be watching where you're moving to next.
Thank you for having me.
Everybody eats when they come to my.
We'll be right back.
Christina, what's on the front page of today's Times Union?
At the top of the page, Florida lawmakers may...
Around the country, volunteers are reading local newspapers to people with vision loss or print disabilities. Did you know WJCT has this service? On a special radio we provide, you'll get the Florida Times Union every day. Learn more at wjct.org/radio reading. With help from sponsors like Florida Eye Specialists, radio reading gives voice to the printed word.
From the roots of jazz with Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis to contemporary artists like Melody Gardot and Eric Truffaz, 89.9 HD4 plays nonstop jazz 24/7 for the month of May.
Welcome back. Well, the Women's Giving Alliance just released a landmark new report on mental health, and it looks at the impact of 5 years of grant making on mental health services here in Northeast Florida. Sounds great, but something else we need to stress, there is so much work yet to be done when it comes to all of the issues that stem from insufficient mental health funding and treatment, especially for women and girls. Karen Mayfield is with the Women's Giving Alliance and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And let's begin by explaining that the Women's Giving Alliance is an incredible organization of women putting their dollars to work collectively to bring positive results on the most pressing issues in this community, particularly those that affect women and girls. Can you tell me a little bit more about your mental health strategic focus report? There are some amazing findings in here.
Sure. Thank you, Melissa. We're very excited about it. We just released it officially yesterday. It is a 40-page report for those that are interested. It is available on the website, but we've now narrowed it down into a 12-page executive summary. And it highlights the issues of why we've had the focus, what we learned through the focus, the work that still needs to be done. And as you said, there is a lot of work to still be done. But we feel over those 5-6 years of grants, we've made significant accomplishments in that field.
You have helped nearly 9,000 women and girls in Northeast Florida. They've received mental health services over the last decade, thanks to the WGA's almost $2 million in grants. These are initiatives that really make a difference for the most vulnerable in our society, our local society. Where did the money go, first off?
The money went to, so when you are a member of WGA, right, so of that commitment or that investment is $1,500, $1,000 goes into this grant pool. So over that period of time, it was a $2 million grant pool that we have built, and it went to 17 different agencies within the Northeast Florida area. And I think that's important because with WGA, Women's Giving Alliance, it is a collective giving circle, and our focus is to make sure that those monies stay here for the women and girls. Mm-hmm. So it is in our 5 counties. There were 23 grants, and we served 17 different agencies with different areas of focus. And part of that was what we learned from the agencies of what's important and how they see ways for us to be partners in addressing the mental health needs for women and girls.
Right. Everyone from the PACE Center for Girls to the Sulzbacher Center for the Homeless, Volunteers in Medicine, Gateway Community Services, Rethreaded. These are all amazing local nonprofits. And can you explain why this money is so needed? Because I don't think people often realize Florida ranks 50th among our 50 states when it comes to spending and support for mental health services.
Yeah, so that's
we are the bottom.
We are the bottom, and that's not a place that we like to be. And so I think that was really very insightful for us when we did our research. And when we shared that with the women, with the Women's Giving Alliance, the room went silent. I don't think people realize that Florida is 50th in the level of funding for the states. And so that really tells us that there's an opportunity to help these women. Certainly there's other areas where we focus, certainly from a Medicaid funding. There's opportunities potentially. But really recognizing to get the word out, to begin the conversations around mental health are important. These are conversations people were not comfortable sharing that word. And today we're finding people are talking about it more openly and recognizing the services that people do need.
You recognize a clear need for better access and mental health care solutions in Florida. Quoting here from the report, in our area of Northeast Florida, one in every four adults is living with a mental illness. Most mental illnesses can be effectively treated, but 60% of adults, 50% of kids are never diagnosed or treated. A majority of people with mental illness are incarcerated. Our jails are our primary mental health facilities in Florida. You also look at the shootings last year at Parkland High School, the mass shooting that prompted a statewide push for at least some more funding for mental health counselors in Florida's schools. That's another piece of this puzzle as well, because you're focused on adult women, but also mental health services for girls.
Correct. Correct. We focus a lot on girls that go into the juvenile justice system. Unfortunately, they are not treated. And so they go into the system. There becomes addiction issues, their truancy issues, and recognizing that they don't have the support system at home, potentially. They're in the juvenile justice system, which is not the place where they need for mental health services. So it's, again, partnering with the agencies like the Dolores Barr Weaver Policy Center to really bring these girls in and surround them with the support that they need. And it goes beyond just mental health counseling. Mm-hmm. When we think of mental health services, we think of counselors, and they are a critical component of that process. But there's so much more that goes into that, that again, it's through expressive therapy, through yoga, through art, through collaboration with different agencies coming together to really put their arms around the girls is what we've learned and what we see to really help our community.
And you've done so much good, but there is so much still to be done. When you work with these agencies, what are the greatest needs that are still unmet, and how do you hope to address them?
Well, it's a great question. So I think part of it is communication. The greatest need is access to care and the coordination of care. As you said, prisons are really the place where mental health services are, but they're not equipped to do that. And so what the agencies have told us, I think it's a combination of the coordination of access to care and helping these women navigate the system. The system can be very complicated. Mm-hmm. And so it's having these agencies work together so that when they need the help, there's not a 3-month wait time for them to see somebody. And that's early. So it's getting them in within a week to get the care that they need. And it's helping the agencies with the resources they need, with partnerships like with Florida Blue, like with Baptist, to really be able to partner and to help these individuals. So a lot of work to be done. I think some of the challenge, we don't have a spokesperson in our community for mental health. It's a very personal, a very private topic, but I think getting the conversation started, there's a lot of work to be done. There's a huge gap, certainly from a funding level, but I think continuing to have the conversations. Florida Blue is taking an initiative to begin steps into a new initiative in Orlando around this, and we are very excited. But I think part of it's just the conversations and awareness.
The more we talk about this, the more we can blast away the stigma around mental health issues, because mental health issues should be treated the same in our medical system, in our government, in our funding mechanisms as physical health problems.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes. And it's interesting because I think we're getting there. It's slowly. But I remember when we first made that announcement that we were going into mental health for our focus, people kind of step back, right? Because that's a big topic, and it's one that's very personal and private. But I think having—
That's what perpetuates the stigma, though.
It's so true.
Not talking openly.
And I think now that we are, and I think for the WGA members and hopefully the community, we're learning terms that we hadn't been aware of before around how we help people.
Like what?
So we've learned things about like expressive therapy, right? So we didn't know what that was. And to some people, but it's having them work through that trauma, through whether that's yoga, whether that's art, whether that's poetry, in coordination with the counseling. So those are the beginning of I guess, what we've learned as members of WGA that we just were not familiar with. And again, the agencies has educated us on these are other resources that are available. And it's a bold step for us to go out and mm-hmm. make these grants into an arena that at one point was kind of a taboo topic. And now we're very proud that people are talking about that so openly, or at least beginning to talk about it as more openly.
You know, the Women's Giving Alliance has served as just a shining light of leadership in this community, stepping up where government has failed, where corporations have, you know, these are women, these are all private citizens mm-hmm. who have joined this organization, and everybody pays a certain amount of money to join. And then you leverage the collective impact of your dollars in such a powerful way. I mean, I can't say enough good things about it. And I urge everyone to support the Women's Giving Alliance. And if you can afford to do so, join the Women's Giving Alliance. You can go to their website at WGANEFL.org and learn more right now about their mental health strategic focus that they've been working on for years, by the way.
Yes.
Not just a year or two. This has been a huge project. So it's so exciting to see the results of it. And Karen Mayfield, kudos to you for your work and your leadership on this. Again, Women's Giving Alliance is at WGANEFL.org. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa. Appreciate it.
I'll see you soon. And in a moment, the youngest movers and shakers on the First Coast. Void lives, 35 under 35. Who made the list? Including someone right here at WJCT. We'll find out right after this.
A lot of people are excited that I mentioned on the air yesterday that I'll be on Fresh Air with Terry Gross on NPR.
It happened. I recorded an interview with Howard Stern, and there was so much to talk about, we've made it a two-parter. You can hear part one on the next Fresh Air. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Have baby boomers stolen the millennials' future with their economic policies? That's the argument of a new book by The Wall Street Journal's Joseph Sternberg.
The boomers created a very secure and comfortable today for their millennial children, but where I think they really ran into trouble was thinking about long-term security for millennials.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
In rural areas across America, many hospitals are struggling to stay open.
They just don't have as many patients coming through the door as other geographic areas may have, and so that can be problematic.
I'm Amy Scott. What's a town to do when its hospital closes? That's next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
These days, we're pretty good at labeling people we don't like. No wonder we can't work through our differences. Irshad Manji is taking on our tendency to get offended, to push away people we disagree with. Can we learn to appreciate people's complexities and their politics? Irshad Manji on her new book, Don't Label Me. Next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, Void Magazine is out with its first ever Bold Movers issue, and it profiles 35 local leaders under the age of 35 who
who are making their mark. Editor Matt Shaw is here now with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And we're excited to point out that on your 35 Under 35 list, our own podcast host and producer, Lindsay Kilbride, is on the list.
Yeah, Lindsay.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's great.
And so we're so proud of Lindsay and her podcast, What It's Like. She'll be producing more podcasts for people to listen to. So kudos, Lindsay. And there are 35 other names on here. How did you guys decide who made the cut? Who's featured here?
Yeah, so we started with the idea of doing maybe 30 under 30 so we could hem like close to our readership demographic. And then as we kind of started looking into it, there's a lot of research and literature out there about millennials and Xennials and Generation Y about how they're getting started a little later in life, changing jobs throughout their 20s. And then like reflecting on my own experience, I'm 33.
You should have put yourself on the list.
Right. Yeah, I don't think I would get away with that. But, my last semester of college was 2008, the fall of 2008. And I remember the economic collapse like pretty vividly. And I think when you look at this list of people in the 35 under 35, all these people kind of came of age mm-hmm. and started making an impact in a world that looked vastly different than it did from, before that recession happened. And you mentioned Lindsay Kilbride. And I think like as an example, just the people that we put on the list from media, you have like Nate Monroe, I know has been on First Coast Connect.
Times
from
Union
Florida
columnist.
Times Union.
Mm-hmm.
So, he's doing that kind of old school journalism grunt work, covering City Hall for a daily newspaper that's, the circulation of dailies across the country are declining, readership's going down, but he's puts his nose to the grindstone, is doing very important work. And then you have somebody like Chelsea Dudevoix, who founded Babes Who Hustle, which is kind of a new media platform where they focus on women doing amazing things, like not in just in this community, but across the country.
Yeah.
But they also do events and a book club and have merch and kind of She's sort of when I interviewed her, she talks about kind of like just stumbling into this new media thing. She wanted to be a writer, wanted to be a journalist, but the circumstances dictated her doing something different. And then Lindsay Kilbride, who has a amazing podcast, like I don't know when she went to journalism school, but I don't think podcasts were a thing, 10 years ago.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. And that's, I think, reflective of your list. You've got a group that's really on the cutting edge of a lot of different technologies and new ideas. You've got filmmaker Keegan Ann Fuso, I know, her documentary, The Gray Area, is about gender identity. You've got a city official, Brittany Norris, on the Atlantic mm-hmm. Beach City Commission as younger people start to get elected to public office.
Yeah, and I know I was listening earlier and you guys were talking about, the local elections and stuff. And I think, the numbers, the turnout and it is kind of paltry and that's disappointing. But I think when you look at a list like this and you see the ways, kind of our litmus test for who we included on the list was, not only are you excelling in your field, but what are you doing with your skills to, advance your community? And so when you look at this list, I think you can kind of project into the future and see like these are all people who are making a difference and the future looks bright for Jacksonville and Northeast Florida when you look at the list.
I think. It's a good list. Pick up Void Live and take a look at 35 Under 35. These are the young movers and shakers doing amazing things in this community. Let's quickly mention too, you have an event coming up May 24th. For anyone that wants to support Void Live.
Yeah, we have our annual charity golf fundraiser, Let Freedom Swing.
nice.
Yeah, we have. So you're encouraged to dress up in your patriotic garb and have a fun day on the golf course. It's at Jack's Beach Golf Club. We have a ton of events in the summer. We have the Sip and Slide at Adventure Landing. And we're also, we haven't announced this yet, but I feel comfortable saying, we're going to do volume 2 of our Void on vinyl, record. And we're going to have a release party for that sometime in June as well. So
lots going on. Go to voidlive.com and pick up the paper copy of 35 Under 35. Editor Matt Shaw, who's also under 35. Kudos to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kudos to our own Lindsay Kilbride and everyone else on the list. These kids are all right.
The kids are all right.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Here's a little music just for you, Matt. That's fine.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.